Picatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Picatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are immersing ourselves in, well, one of the most culturally defining memoirs of the last couple of decades, Elizabeth Gilbert's iconic Eat, Pray, Love. It really became this undeniable blueprint for radical life reconstruction for so many people.
It's such a fascinating book because it really taps into a very universal, profound feeling of dissatisfaction, doesn't it? It poses that vital question. Mm. You know, when you've achieved the life society told you was good, the marriage, the home, the stable career, and yet you feel hollow, disconnected, and just fundamentally lost, what do you do then?
Yeah, it's that quest for identity outside the usual script, that moment when you realize maybe you need to dismantle everything to figure out who you actually are. So we're going to deep dive into that reconstruction roadmap today.
Okay, but before we get into the journey itself, maybe let's look at the woman who wrote it, Elizabeth Gilbert. She wasn't, you know, some unknown blogger when this memoir hit shelves back in 2006. She was already quite an established American author, essayist, journalist.
And that's interesting to me. She had serious journalistic chops, right? Mm. Published in GQ, the New York Times Magazine. And her earlier nonfiction, The Last American Man, that was a National Book Award finalist. So that background, it definitely gave her the narrative skill, the prowess to document her own personal crisis with such clarity.
Absolutely. That analytical approach is really key. But what's also interesting, I think, is the tension between that professional credibility and her role here. She's not writing as like an expert observer looking outwards.
Right. She is the subject.
Exactly.
And for some people, maybe that's where the relatability question pops up. You know, how relatable is a quest for self-discovery when the person doing it already has this credibility and while the financial means to just liquidate everything and fund a year of global travel?
It's a fair question, definitely. But I think the memoir's authority stems less from any sort of financial privilege and much more from her just radical vulnerability. Mm-hmm. I mean, she lays out her emotional breakdown, the confusion, the despair, those awful legal battles with just unflinching honesty. She positions herself as this often flawed, modern fellow seeker, really documenting the breakdown and the reconstruction.
Ah, okay.
And that accessibility, that willingness to admit, you know, profound failure, that's what turned it from just a travelogue into a real manifesto for a lot of readers.
So that's the core of her perspective then, authority born from, well, from failure and vulnerability. Okay, so let's talk about the book's central idea. This conscious dismantling of a life that just wasn't working. It ultimately boiled down to a quest for balance, didn't it?
Exactly. Gilbert realized her life was unbalanced because she'd neglected some really fundamental aspects of her own well-being. The core insight, really, is that true contentment needs a harmonious balance of three human needs. And these conveniently dictated the structure of her year-long pilgrimage. It was a very methodical attempt to heal the body, the spirit, and the heart.
Which gives us that iconic three-part structure we all know.
Yes, Eat, which is Italy. That's about grounding herself in earthly pleasure, healing the body, learning to really savor the moment without judging herself.
Mm-hmm.
Then Pray. In India, that shifts the focus entirely to spiritual devotion, disciplining that unruly ego, and confronting the chaos of what she calls the monkey mind.
And then finally, Love in Indonesia, which kind of serves as the crucial integration phase.
That's right. That's where she tries to synthesize the sort of worldly pleasure of Italy with the spiritual discipline she found in India, allowing for authentic connection, which she finds, maybe surprisingly, through a healthy new relationship. It's all about finding an identity rooted in her own personal truth, not, you know, external validation.
Okay, let's unpack this journey a bit more then. The book doesn't just start in Rome with pasta, does it? It starts with this moment of just utter brokenness, that awful divorce, the tumultuous rebound relationship, and then that famous moment of prayer on her bathroom floor, her arrival in Rome. It marks a really desperate, deliberate shift towards piacere pleasure.
Yeah, and the descriptions of Italy are just, they're essential, aren't they? Gilbert needed to reclaim joy. She needed to heal her relationship with the physical world, which for her had become a source of anxiety and self-criticism.
She goes from that despair to this almost lavish pleasure in Italy. Does that immediate kind of radical shift, does it risk being purely escapist? Or was it genuinely essential healing?
That's a really good question. And I think Gilbert argues strongly that it was essential healing. She wasn't running away from something. She was running towards sensory reality, you know. She let herself indulge in the perfect Neapolitan pizza, the fresh pasta, the gelato. It was this radical act of self-care against all the guilt that had defined her life before. It was about appreciating the physical world with, like, passion and reverence again.
And it wasn't only the food, right? It was the whole pace of life. That wonderful phrase, dolce far niente.
Ah, yes, the sweetness of doing nothing.
Yeah.
That concept is pretty revolutionary for anyone, I think, who feels chained to constant productivity. For Gilbert, learning to just sit in cafes, watch life go by, and simply be present, that was such a necessary contrast to her hyper-scheduled American life. By grounding herself in the physical world, reclaiming simple joy, she basically prepared herself for the really hard internal work that was still ahead.
Okay, so the body is grounded, it's fed in Italy. But that external pleasure, it was only preparation, wasn't it? Because the shift to India and the inner struggle required there, it's a massive contrast.
Completely. If Italy was about healing the body, India was absolutely about confronting the mind. She checks into the ashram, embraces this really rigorous schedule, super early morning chants, long hours of silent meditation, and, you know, selfless service.
Right. And when she describes the mind in that period as a bad neighborhood, just full of guilt, regret, obsessive thoughts, I mean, anyone who's ever tried to meditate for even 5 minutes knows that struggle is profoundly real. How did she find the motivation, the drive to push through that daily grind?
Well, she found a really crucial, maybe counterintuitive guide, Richard from Texas.
Ah, groceries.
Yeah, nicknamed Groceries. He's this gruff, wise mentor figure who doesn't really offer gentle self-help platitudes. He gives brutally honest assessments. And he helps her see that her main obstacle wasn't actually the demanding schedule of the ashram, but her own inability to forgive herself for the perceived mistakes of her past.
Ah, okay. So India is less about achieving some grand spiritual enlightenment and maybe more about the really tough, unglamorous grunt work of spiritual practice. Taming that monkey mind, achieving some kind of emotional self-sufficiency.
Precisely.
Yeah.
She establishes a spiritual core, but it's built on discipline and, crucially, self-forgiveness.
Which brings us to the final stop, Bali, Indonesia, the integration phase. So she's rediscovered worldly pleasure. She's established the spiritual core. The goal here is synthesis, right? Bringing it all together.
Exactly. She goes to Bali seeking balance. Initially, she's guided by the old medicine man, Catoot Lyer. Catoot offers this sort of playful, often cryptic wisdom. But the biggest shift, I think, comes when her spiritual practice moves beyond just herself.
Right. She starts practicing service. She grounds her spiritual work in the community by helping her friend Wayan Muriasi, who's a Balinese single mother, helping her organize support to buy a house.
That act of service is just vital. It shifts her focus from purely self-healing to the well-being of others. Kind of completes the spiritual grounding, but translating her inner work into real outward compassion.
But the journey has one last major hurdle, doesn't it? Meeting Felipe, this charismatic Brazilian expat, after all her devastating emotional experiences, she'd vowed celibacy for the year. So this relationship forces her to confront that deep-seated fear of love, of intimacy.
And that's the central tension of the whole love section, really. She finally has this sense of self-possession, this strength she's built, and now she has to risk potentially losing it by, you know, giving herself over to someone else. What allows her to move forward, ironically, is realizing that balance isn't about rigid isolation.
And this is where Catoot Lyer comes in with that incredibly important line.
Yes. To lose balance sometimes for love is part of living a balanced life. And this is really the culmination of the whole memoir. She realizes that wholeness means having the wisdom to navigate complexity, to take emotional risks, not just hide from them. She chooses a healthy partnership, but from a place of strength this time, not neediness, because she's integrated all three parts of her journey.
That dynamic understanding of balance, that it actually includes risk, that might be the biggest takeaway. Okay, let's step back now and look at the key messages, the themes that made this memoir resonate so powerfully around the world.
Well, the first message is pretty fundamental. The courage to start over. Now, while Gilbert's choice was, you know, extreme liquidating assets and all that, the underlying message really speaks to the non-financial, the emotional risk of abandoning an identity you've already established.
It's not just the money she risked losing. It's the security, right? The known path, the validation you get from others.
Exactly. The real courage lies in willingly stepping into that unknown, trusting that you can actually rebuild something more authentic on the other side.
Okay. Then there's the integration principle, which is kind of the thesis of the whole book.
A fulfilling life has to hold both, right? The worldly delights of eat and the spiritual discipline of pray. If you neglect either one, you create an imbalance that leads either to, well, empty hedonism or this kind of detached asceticism. The goal is to be fully engaged with the world while also staying spiritually centered.
And finally, the book makes a really powerful argument for redefining success.
It fundamentally challenges those conventional benchmarks we have for achievement, you know, wealth, status, marital state. Success, Gilbert argues, is actually measured by inner peace, by joy, by authenticity, and the validation of self-discovery as a primary human quest.
Yeah.
That just struck such a chord with millions of people who felt kind of hollow inside their outwardly successful lives.
This memoir is also known for being just incredibly quotable. She somehow managed to translate these huge philosophical ideas into these powerful, memorable lines that really stay with you long after you finish reading.
She was brilliant at that, wasn't she? Okay, first let's revisit that idea of catastrophic failure. Ruin is a gift. Ruin is the road to transformation.
That's powerful, yeah. But for many listeners, maybe ruin means genuine, disaster-like financial ruin or deep emotional scarring. How does Gilbert manage to frame destruction not just as necessary for creation, but as a gift?
Well, she argues that total ruin, it strips away everything you thought you wanted, or maybe everything society told you to want, and it leaves behind only the absolute foundation of yourself. So it's a gift because it forces authenticity. When you feel like you have nothing left to lose, you suddenly have this radical freedom to finally build something that's true to you.
Okay. Second, that mantra from the Italian section. We call it dolce far niente, the sweetness of doing nothing.
That's such a revolutionary concept, especially in a society like ours, that often judges personal worth based on constant measurable output, on productivity. It's like an antidote to anxiety. The recognition that finding pleasure in simple idleness, in just being, is crucial for recharging the spirit.
And the third idea, this is perhaps the most empowering one in the whole book because it places the burden and also the reward squarely on the individual.
That would be. Happiness is the consequence of personal effort. It means happiness isn't some passive state you just stumble into, like finding a lucky penny. It's an active choice. It's a conscious practice. It's a discipline you actually have to pursue, much like, you know, meditation or learning a new language. You have to take ownership of your emotional state.
So for the vast majority of us who, let's face it, cannot liquidate our assets and spend a year traveling the globe, how do we apply these massive principles to our real lives? What's this MicroQuest framework about?
The MicroQuest framework basically adapts the EPL model locally on a smaller scale. So for eat, you seek out local opportunities for pleasure. Maybe take a cooking class, explore a new type of cuisine nearby, or even just commit to savoring one meal a day without distraction, without your phone.
Okay. And for pray, you definitely don't need to join an ashram.
Right. Exactly. You could start a 10-minute daily meditation practice. Or maybe commit to regular journaling, just to observe your own monkey mind. The goal is that internal discipline and, again, that self-forgiveness piece.
And then for love, the integration part.
Invest in community. That can mean volunteering or simply working on being more present and open in the relationships you already have. Or maybe conduct what you might call a life audit. Just honestly look at whether your daily routines actually align with your core values. The key is practicing intentionality and trying not to hide from vulnerability.
You know, the thing that surprised me most about this book's impact was how it just gave millions of people a language for their own quiet discontent. And it asserted that, actually, you have the power to be the author of your own life. Its unique value, I think, is that vulnerability and accessibility. It proved that profound healing doesn't necessarily require mastery, just courage.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, maybe the most valuable insight is that true happiness really requires deliberate internal development across all dimensions, the physical, the spiritual, the relational. The goal isn't some kind of static perfection. It's understanding that true balance is actually a dynamic process. And it absolutely requires taking risks sometimes, which is why, as Ketut said, we must sometimes be willing to lose balance for love.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker. Another powerful book and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.